This is Shades of Green Energy, Austin's live green talk radio show with your hosts, John Hoffner, Deborah Dubay, and Reed Sternberg.
We're live on 91.7 FM KOOP Hornsby, Austin, Thursdays from 1 to 2 p.m. and streaming live online at KOOP.org.
Get program information and download past shows at shadesofgreenenergy.org.
The views expressed here are not necessarily the views of KOOP Radio, its board of directors, volunteers, staff, or underwriters.
All right, welcome back to another week of Shades of Green Energy, your weekly talk show with green talk for all of you. Today we have two interesting guests, and we are zeroing in on the Texas legislature and environment and green energy issues. I'm your host, John Hoffner. With me in the studio is Reed Sternberg, and our third wheel, Deborah Dubay, is on vacation this week, so it's you and me, Reed. So the big question is, did the sun shine at all on our Texas legislature this year?
Good, bad, or ugly?
Good, bad, or ugly. Did it get into that chamber? Did they talk about it? We know they talked, at least maybe talked about it. But I really am excited about our guest today. We have Kate Galbraith, who is a reporter for the Texas Tribune. So welcome, Kate.
Thanks for having me.
Yep. And we also have Colin Meehan from the Environmental Defense Fund, and he's the clean energy analyst for EDF.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, well, thanks for coming back. I guess before we get into the background of both of you, EDF keeps changing its name. I think that maybe even the last time we had you on about 2 years ago, it was ED, right?
No. You know, I've been with EDF for about three and a half years now, and it's been EDF all that time.
So it has?
It was ED before that, Environmental Defense before that, but it's been pretty stable for a while now, although we do have a new logo.
Uh-oh, new logo, but same name.
Same name.
But so prior to when you were there, it was called ED. But then even before that, they were EDF, right? So it
yes.
kind of flip-flopped.
Yeah. You know, okay. we can't make up our minds sometimes.
All right. Well, that's Colin Meehan from EDF. So Colin, we'll go to you first. Give us a little bit of background on you and how you ended up doing what you're doing, being interested in Environmental Defense Fund issues and how you got to Austin.
Sure. Well, I've worked in the electric utility industry for about 10 years. I lived in Washington, D.C. for a while as a wholesale power analyst for an economic consulting firm. And then I moved down here to Austin to work for the Lower Colorado River Authority, which has been in the news a bit lately.
It's
our other local utility. And I've always had an interest in clean energy and renewable energy in particular, and that's what brought me to Environmental Defense Fund.
Well, that's interesting, Colin. I've known you for a while, and I didn't know you worked for LCRA. How long were you there for?
Really just about a year. It was they hired me for, this is maybe a little technical, but the transition of the market to the nodal market, and that got pushed back a while, so I ended up looking for something that would give me a little bit more to do in my spare time.
Well, we're glad you're at EDF.
I am too.
Keeping an eye on the legislature and all the other environmental issues. And also with us in the studio again is Kate Galbraith. Kate, to give us a little bit of background, she's a reporter for the Texas Tribune, but I know you've had a colorful background as well, so give us some background on you.
Well, I actually started out writing travel guides when I was in college. I wrote for the Let's Go guides, which are, you know, targeted at college students. And then also when I graduated, the Lonely Planet guides, I wrote places like Micronesia. And then I realized, well, I don't just want to be writing about hotels and restaurants and things. I'd love to be writing about, you know, real issues. It was fun. Don't
Not
get
much
me wrong.
Depth in that, huh?
Yeah, right. But you know, and the price of the laundromat, I mean, that drove me nuts. But,
that's important. An important data point, huh?
Yes. Anyhow, and then I was fortunate enough to get a job at The Economist magazine in London. I worked there a while, and eventually I wanted to move back to the States, and they sent me to Texas, and I bounced around a little after that. I went to New York Times for a little bit, and then I got laid off, and I came back here and joined the Texas Tribune and having a blast.
Yeah, well, that's great. And again, we're glad you're here, too. So I didn't realize you had come to Texas and then went to the New York Times.
Yeah, I thought it was a little hot the first time, but yeah, now it's hot but fun.
Yeah. So, I mean, maybe this is just coincidence, but maybe you're following Molly Ivins a little bit. Didn't she go to the New York Times and did she get laid off?
She had a little run-in with the New York Times. That's right.
Yeah.
I didn't have a run-in. They just, you know, put me aside.
Ran out of money. Huh?
Exactly.
Oh, wow. All right. Well, that's great. You kind of queued this up a little bit, Colin. You've been doing some great articles in your Texas Tribune about the water issue here, which is amazingly hot right now, Kate, and I'm enjoying it's a five-part series that you're working on now, and maybe tell us about that. And maybe before that, how do people access your Texas Tribune?
Sure. We're running this five-part series on Central and Southeast Texas water issues on texastribune.org, and also every morning it's been on KUT. Both radio and print components. And basically, you know, the idea is we're in this very intense drought here. I mean, the state climatologist has told me this is the driest October to May to mid-June stretch we've ever had. And that includes the Dust Bowl in the 1950s.
It does. Okay, so it's surpassed that?
It's more intense. I mean, the 1950s was a deeper drought. It lasted longer, about 10 years. We really hope we're not in,
not in the beginning of a 10-year drought, huh?
It would be a nightmare. Yeah, but, you know, and so water is scarce all around the state, and the Highland Lakes, particularly Lake Travis and Lake Buchanan, which serve as reservoirs for us in Austin and also rice farmers downstream, they're about 28-29% below normal, below average.
Yeah, I saw that.
It's a little alarming.
And when we compare to the drought of the 50s, aren't we also comparing to a time when we had much less water needs? It seems to me like the relative to our water needs, this is pretty desperate times even compared to that.
That's right. I mean, obviously the population of Austin has grown tremendously, yeah. And you have all these other cities around springing up and so on.
Yeah. But what I thought was particularly interesting about your article, and I didn't realize this, is that the rice farmers use twice as much as the entire city of Austin. So that if you cut off all of the usage in Austin, it's the rice farmers that use the bulk of the water.
Yeah, I mean, you think rice fields and, you know, yeah, they're sort of flooded with water. This is how they work. They're way downriver, maybe 200 miles away from us, but they release water out of the Highland Lakes, and it takes 5 or 7 days to sort of travel down the river to irrigate these fields. They use 57% of the water out of those two lakes.
Incredible. That actually just blew me away. I know that agriculture is a huge consumer of water. When I was actually out in California, I think it was in the 70s, and they had a big drought. And they had all these sayings, you know, if it's yellow, let it mellow, don't flush it down. And it was kind of funny. But I read something that said that 95% of the water consumption in the state of California was for big ag farms like that. So even if all the residential people reduced their consumption to zero, they could only cut the state's water consumption by 5%. So we're not quite in that situation here in the Highland Lakes, but the battle that you're seeing is between the cities, the rice farmers, and then stuck in the middle is LCRA, right?
Right, stuck in the middle is LCRA, and also the people who live around the lakes who see their boat docks coming out of the water, and they're like, is anyone going to come visit the lakes again?
Yeah, the economic effect on that.
Yeah, the lake's getting farther and farther away from their houses.
Yeah, I was actually amazed. I went out to, I ride my bike a lot out in North Austin, and went out to, what's the road? There's Lime Creek Road and Bullock Hollow, and there's usually a park there. There's an LCRA park there that's usually full of water, and the water was probably half a mile out from that point, and houses with their docks dry as a bone. So the economic impact is going to be amazing. And one of your articles was actually about that, right? The whole effect on the city. And
yeah, that's right. Austin, the trees here are drying up and stuff, and around the lakes as well. I mean, it's very serious for a lot of people. And there's also a coal plant that's been proposed for way down the river. And, you know, power plants actually use a tremendous amount of water for cooling their operations. And, you know, the LCRA delayed a decision about whether to give that coal plant water. That'll be reheard August 10th.
Oh, is that when it is?
Yeah.
So they've just put it off. They didn't deny it.
Yeah, it's been put off.
Yeah. So that's probably one of the issues that EDF has been involved in. Is that right, Colin?
Yeah, we've been involved in what we're calling the Energy Water Nexus for a number of years now. My colleague Amy Hardberger has been working on that for a long time, and that was a big part of our work in White Stallion and a couple of other coal plants and just general the energy usage in Texas. It's a very big issue.
Yeah. Well, how much, or maybe you don't know the statistic, but how much is the water expected to be of the coal plant? It was significant, but nothing near what the rice farmers would use.
Yeah. Right. I mean, they would use, I think, up to about 15% or so of what Austin uses in a year. So that's
a lot for one site and for a coal plant that is questionable whether it's...
We've got about 19 other coal plants in the state, and they're all using water to keep themselves cool. So when you talk about the entire energy infrastructure, there's a lot of water use there.
But there's also this sort of irony that also in order to get water, you need a lot of energy, you know, which is what Colin was talking about the energy water nexus. It sort of goes both ways. I mean, to pump up water from lakes or streams or, you know, desalinate it. I mean, those are very energy intensive operations. So yeah, it's kind of very much intertwined.
Yep. It is the nexus of water and energy. And I always think it's ironic. We did some work at my company for Tucson, the city of Tucson. The irony there is what they do is they pump the water out of the Colorado River in near California, up and over the mountains, back down again, and then put it in the ground, store it in the ground for future use, because if they don't take the water it's a take-or-pay type thing where they don't take it from the river, then they lose it, and somebody else downstream gets it. So they take it. And the only reason they can afford it is because the Army Corps of Engineers plays for all the pumping, because it's huge pumps to get it up and over the mountains. So, and you may know this, in fact, I'm sure you do, Colin, that the city of Austin, one of the biggest customers for electricity, is the water department for all its pumps.
Absolutely.
And I guess that was similar for LCRA, a lot of pumping and needs for the water.
Yeah, yeah. There's just a strong tie in both directions, both the water pumping use of energy and vice versa.
Yeah, well, being an insider at LCRA, what do you think? Are they gonna solve all this? And I guess an interesting comment you also made in your article, Kate, was that if it's a severe drought, and I don't remember what triggers it, and you may know this too from LCRA, Colin, that they can actually shut off the water to the. The contract with the rice farmers is that if it's a severe drought, they'll forego their water.
That's right, but that's never actually happened.
Never happened.
And the trigger point is actually not just a number of the lake level, but it's a date. You know, if the lakes are this low in January, the farmers will face reductions in their water. But it's June,
so
they don't.
So it won't happen until next year, maybe.
That's right.
They're good for this year. And is that whatever it is, 900,000?
900,000 acre feet is what triggers further reductions in Austin. Yeah, and we're at about 1.2 million acre feet right now. So, you know, it could be, they're saying Austin could be down to one day a week watering by late August, early September. I mean, we could hit that trigger. The lakes are going down real fast. We had this great rain the other night.
I was out of town for that. I didn't see. Was it a great rain? I mean, I didn't notice how many inches we got, but was it all of Austin or probably fairly sporadic, wasn't it?
I sure got it in South Austin. I woke up to this big thunderstorm at 1:30 in the morning. I was like, yay.
Celebration, huh?
We got just a little bit, I think, in North, unless I just slept through all of it, but we got just a little bit in North Central.
Did you? So. Yeah. Well, it obviously didn't fill up the reservoirs, and they're still struggling. But didn't we hit that trigger in 2009?
Yeah, we did. That's right, for a couple of months. Yeah, and then it rained.
Yeah.
This may be slightly off topic, but I get frustrated by our obsession with green rectangles and that we have to get to that desperate measure to go to a one-day-a-week kind of situation. We got to turn up.
Just a general lifestyle. It should always be that way.
Yeah.
Yeah, everybody needs to take responsibility. All right, you're listening to Shades of Green Energy here at your community radio station, KOOP Hornsby Austin. And you can also hear us streaming on the web at koop.org. And for interest in our past shows of Shades of Green Energy, you can go to our website, which is shadesofgreenenergy.org, and download the podcast. And also, thanks to Deborah, we are available on iTunes. Okay, we're back with our guests. We've got Kate Galbraith from the Texas Tribune and Colin Meehan, the clean energy analyst. And now we're going to kind of shift gears and talk about how well or how not so well our Texas legislature is doing. And maybe, Colin, you'll weigh in first and talk about some of the bills. But I will say that, Kate, you had an awesome article that summarized all the energy efficiency bills that we, I guess, got through, or the legislature got through. And also, maybe you can comment on this, that the Statesman said that this is one of the greenest greenest legislatures we've had. Let's talk about that.
I missed that article.
Did you?
Yeah, I'll have to go back and look for that. You know, as I look back on the legislative session, really what I see most of are missed opportunities. One of the biggest ones actually kind of relates to what we were talking about earlier. There's been a state water plan for several years now, and yet again, they've failed to fund it. And this is a plan for the future of, this isn't even necessarily an environmental plan. It does involve some water conservation, but this is just the future of how we're going to obtain water in the state of Texas. Mm. Yet again, that wasn't funded.
What do you think is behind that paralysis?
Well, you know, funding anything was difficult this session. I mean, yeah. I have to admit that.
It's about the dollar.
Understatement, isn't it?
Yeah. I'm being kind. but the other real big missed opportunity that I saw, at least, was in the solar industry in particular, and the renewable energy industry, speaking more largely. There were a couple of very good bills that would have done a lot to bring solar energy to the state of Texas and a lot of jobs, and unfortunately, most of those didn't really go anywhere. They weren't really heard in the whole House or the whole Senate. They didn't really make it out of committee.
Didn't get out of the committee, right?
Yeah, and that was really unfortunate to see for a couple of reasons. I think there was a lot of support behind those bills, but also at the same time, you know, as we look to the future, Texas is an energy state, and some of this legislation, at least, is really going to bring or could have brought a lot of jobs to the state. And actually, we just saw earlier this week with San Antonio's announcement of some of the solar work that they're going to be doing locally. They're able to bring some jobs to San Antonio. Mm-hmm. If we had that kind of stability for the solar industry in Texas, you'd see a lot more jobs coming here. So I think that was a big missed opportunity. The things that we did get, and that includes on solar issues and energy efficiency issues, in my opinion, we did make some positive steps forward, but they were very, very small steps.
Little tokens, huh?
Well, I don't know if I would call them tokens. They're certainly meaningful, but they're things that, in my opinion, could have been resolved a long time ago, frankly, at the regulatory level by the Public Utilities Commission, but they've been unwilling to take some of them on. And even those issues that we did get, for instance, the Homeowners Association bill, this is an issue that's been a problem for solar companies for a long time. Some homeowners associations can prevent people from installing solar panels on their roofs, and we have a bill now, legislation that passed, that prohibits that, except during a certain period of time that is as yet undefined. Mm-hmm. I feel like every bill that we did get, or almost every bill that we did get that was positive for clean energy in the state, included a couple steps back, which was unfortunate.
When we say a period of time, are we talking about a delay before that takes effect, or are we talking certain times of the year?
No, we're talking for each homeowners association, for each development that is going to have a homeowners association, during the quote-unquote development period, they can make any rules that they would like that pertain to solar, and it's only after that period, which again is undefined in the legislation.
So they get an opportunity to have some grandfathered rules against it then, or
It's just that the development period could last and has lasted in developments for 10 years or more, and during that period they can prevent people still from installing solar panels.
Okay, gotcha.
And sometimes it doesn't have to directly say no solar panels. It can be subtly written into the covenants that says nothing on your roof that is square or has
Absolutely.
A frame on it and is not the same color as the roof.
Absolutely. And it's just, you know, it's one of those, to me at least, it seems like kind of a no-brainer issue. And maybe that's just the way that I look at these things. But it seems that people should have the right to install what they want to on their roof, so long as it's, I don't know, so long as it doesn't reduce the value of other homes, which time and time again we've shown that solar actually increases the value of the neighborhood.
Well, at one point, and you're also a member of Texas Renewable Energy Industry Association, the association put together a kind of a template that other associations could, or homeowners associations could adopt. And it was fairly well written, I thought, and it I can't remember if we said that the panels should be on the back, but there are some that allow it and say, well, as long as you put it on the back of the house, which is kind of vague and really doesn't show off the solar.
There are a lot of homeowners associations that do allow solar panels to be installed so long as they're not, you know, ugly in some fashion, but the problem that we run into time and time again is there are still a number that just don't allow them to be installed, and it just prevents homeowners from doing what they want to with their home. And you know, as long as there are some aesthetic requirements included, it seems like a pretty reasonable ask. And again, if we want to, you know, solar installation jobs are jobs that can't be imported or exported, I should say. And those are real jobs that we've seen a lot of growth in here in Texas, but unfortunately it's still a pretty small market, and this is one of the ways that we could help grow that market.
Yeah, that's true. We had a doctor on the show about 3 months ago that had tried to put in a solar system and was blindsided by his homeowner association that said he needed to take it off. Or actually, I don't know if he – can't remember if he put it on or not. But
he put in some of the infrastructure at least, which was a big expense, yeah.
And he was hoping to have it a Green Builder Certification 5 and a LEED home, and so it dashed all of his hopes. And well, Kate, you had a great article that summarized – a lot of the energy efficiency, and Colin, you already alluded to that. At least we got some good energy efficiency bills, and it was great that you listed each one of them, and maybe you could go over like Senate Bill 1125, which is well, that wasn't really the exciting one. Well, I guess I'll just ask you, what did you find that was reasonable in some of the energy efficiency bills that we got?
Well, it was interesting that there were a whole lot of them. I mean, a real handful. And so that will certainly, you know, it's kind of advancing energy efficiency in, you know, a number of different little ways. I mean, you know, for example, a lot of them were kind of technicalities and requiring better accountability and this sort of thing. But, you know, there's some kind of fun stuff in there, like making it easier for churches to get access to an energy efficiency loan program, that sort of thing. And, you know, changing the way we measure energy efficiency in this. I mean, this is kind of technical, but there's, you know, energy efficiency is a technical subject. It's actually, ironically, it's sort of hard to write about sometimes as a journalist, because, you know, it's like a negative. We're using less, so you can't really see that. It's not like a wind turbine or a solar panel. And so,
that's true.
You know, it's a very technical.
You have to be the bridge between technical writing and mainstream consumption.
Right, exactly.
Yeah, and that is an interesting concept. Well, of course, some of the advocates in the industry have called it negawatts, you know, that you're saving. But when I used to work for the City of Austin Utility, and one of the things that we always struggled with is electricity, you can't see it. You know, water, you can kind of get a handle on how much you use in a month. But as far as electricity, and so we got a lot of people that would call and say, I couldn't have used that much electricity because you can't see it flowing out of your sockets, and it's not something you can get your hands around. But at any rate, one of the interesting bills that I guess I had not realized went through is that now cities and cooperatives have to do some accounting presentation on there. And maybe Colin's the one that's been following that one. And I didn't think that the Texas legislature would ever reach out and try to regulate anything to do with the municipalities and co-ops.
Well, and that was actually a pretty important bill in the sense that we do have a lot of municipalities and co-ops in Texas. They're actually almost half of the market, if not more.
And before you keep going, maybe tell people what that is.
Well, so as I think of it in Texas, we really have two major markets. We have sort of the competitive marketplace that a lot of people outside of the city of Austin are aware of, where you can choose your own electric provider. And then we have municipal utilities such as Austin Energy and San Antonio City Public Service and rural electric co-ops, where basically if you live within their service area territory, that is your utility. And that's the main difference. And as it's happened with energy efficiency over time, there have been some goals set for those utilities that are in competitive markets, but there haven't really been any goals established for the municipalities or the cooperatives. And actually, that's worked out okay in some sense, because we have Austin Energy here is a big leader on energy efficiency, and so is San Antonio City Public Service. But at the same time, while those two utilities lead on that issue, they don't necessarily have anybody to report to about it. And there are a number of other utilities that really haven't been doing a whole lot, or at least not much that we're aware of. And so all this bill really did was to make it a requirement that they report to the State Energy Conservation Office on a regular basis.
Oh,
and it's
it's
really just about transparency of information to see where their efforts are going, so that the people that live in those utility districts can be aware of what their utility is doing to help them save energy and hopefully take advantage of it. That's the ideal situation.
So, and the bill further says that, or maybe this is in Kate's article, that it doesn't require them to do any of the measures.
That's correct.
Yeah, so it's really just an accounting and like you say, visibility note.
Yeah, and I feel like we saw a lot of that this session where as Kate said, there were some sort of technical fixes, and the real progress that we made was in making energy efficiency programs more accessible to people, whether it was through this bill or other pieces of legislation. I think people are going to have better access to learning about what they can take advantage of now, and that is a big move forward, actually. I don't want to sell that short. But at the same time, those are issues that, in my opinion, probably could have been resolved through an easier route than the Texas legislature.
Right. So the Public Utility Commission maybe thought that they didn't have the jurisdiction and were nervous and wanted to pass it up to the legislature.
Exactly. I can understand that they don't want to take on too much authority or too much responsibility. But at the same time, a few of these issues seemed to follow the intent of the legislature in such a way that they should have been able to deal with them years ago. I mean, we had legislation passed in 2006 that set up some of the things that have just finally passed. And of course, some of them the PUC hasn't even dealt with. For instance, the Renewable Portfolio Standard, I know you're aware of that. A bill was passed to require a set-aside for basically solar and geothermal and other non-wind renewable energies, and the PUC still hasn't acted on that.
Yeah. I think they've actually accepted the fact that they have authority to implement that and stand behind it, but now they're just, I guess, dragging their feet. Maybe for our listeners, you could explain the relationship. What does the Public Utility Commission actually do?
I can try. The Public Utility Commission really is the regulatory body that has oversight over the electric market in Texas. So they help set rates for our transmission utilities, and at the same time, they also help to make sure that the market is working well, is working competitively, nobody's taking too much advantage or has too much market power. They also administer a lot of different programs, the energy efficiency programs among them, and some of the renewable energy programs. And so when the legislature passes a bill, oftentimes it has to become a rule through the Public Utilities Commission.
Right. So the Public Utility Commission essentially implements at the behest of the
legislature. Yeah, that's a shorter way of saying it.
Right. Well, but also they have jurisdiction, I mean, rulemaking and actually over ERCOT, right? Don't they have jurisdiction over ERCOT?
They have jurisdiction over ERCOT, and if it really came down to it, if a customer or a group of customers had a serious complaint against their utility, the PUC is usually the forum that they would go to.
Yeah, and that's why I thought that whole municipal and co-op bill was interesting, because they are not regulated at all by the Public Utility Commission. So I don't know, is this an opening? Is this open, get the nose under the tent?
Well, actually, what you're hitting on something that's really kind of important. It's not, because they're reporting to the State Energy Conservation Office, which is in the Comptroller's office. And that's part of the reason that we were able to do that, because they don't want to be regulated. They feel like, and I think rightly so, they feel as though they're regulated by their customers or by their voters, in the case of municipal utilities who get to vote for their board, that sort of thing. So they don't see a need for another level of oversight. And that's certainly a debatable point, but we were able to talk to them and work with them to get to a point where we could create a reporting mechanism that didn't put them in that same space that they were concerned about PUC.
Right. Well, while you're talking about energy efficiency, I guess maybe you could clarify this Senate Bill 1125, which says now it's 0.4% of the energy companies overall. I mean, is that good? I guess it says that the environmentalists like this bill, but is that good?
Well, that's a good question. There's actually some contention about that. I think in the first couple of years, it is a good development. But actually, if you look at the analysis out through 2015 and beyond, it could be a step backwards. And those are the sort of things that I was talking about earlier, where we're making these little little progressions on energy efficiency and other issues, but there's, in some cases at least, there's kind of a hidden step back, and it's really unfortunate to see that. Hopefully, next time around, what we'll see is that this change in the energy efficiency goals has been successful, and so there's a need to increase it. I mean, 0.4% of total electricity demand is a very, very small number. We're talking about 200-300 megawatts for the entire state, when San Antonio has a goal of 750 megawatts, and Austin Energy's already achieved their goal of, I think, 600 or 700 megawatts, and they've set another one for 800 megawatts.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's a very, very small number for the entire state, and I'm hopeful that next time around we'll be able to change it so that it doesn't end up being a step backwards in the future, because that would be unfortunate.
More like a concession than a progression.
All right, well put. All right, you're listening to Shades of Green Energy. We're talking here with Kate Galbraith from the Texas Tribune and Colin Meehan from EDF. I've got queued up here a song that needs to remind us about how much sun we have in Texas. And Reed, your Rick Reed Sternberg had something to do with this. This is it's actually on YouTube,
a nice
little video.
Yeah, all I can tell you about it is that my father actually produced a video last year called Big Hot Texas Sun. It won an award from Environment Texas, but I don't know much beyond that about the song part
of it. It's a great song. I'm going to play it for you. I've played it for you in the past, but this is just a reminder of it, that Texas does have the best solar resource of all the states. And when we get back, we'll talk with Kate about her solar story and what we did and didn't do again in, as far as solar in the legislature.
We keep fiddling around with these fuels that we burn. Oil, gas, and coal, high dollar and nearly gone. We need a fuel that's safe and clean. I'm thinking of the one waiting in the sky, it's that big hot Texas sun.
Why do we keep fiddling while Texas burns? Since the signing of the Kyoto Protocol in 1992, global carbon dioxide emissions from the burning of fossil fuels has actually increased by 35%. And right here in Texas, we're number one.
Every year, Texas belches out almost 1.5 trillion pounds of carbon dioxide. That's more than every other state in the USA. In fact, it's more than every nation in the world except six. Well, Texas, it's time to stop fiddling around burning our environment by burning fossil fuels.
There is one thing in Texas that burns above the rest. Our greatest resource is right over our heads.
Worldwide, energy consumption is measured in quads. A quad is a quadrillion BTUs. That's 15 zeros. In 2006, world energy consumption was about 472 quads. Texas has available 250 quads of solar energy per year, enough to meet the energy needs of more than half the world.
Instead of complaining about those rays, we need to capture them and put them to work providing clean energy.
In a single month, a 2-kilowatt photovoltaic system can prevent 300 pounds of coal from being mined.
And can prevent 600 pounds of CO2 from entering the atmosphere.
It also keeps nitrous oxide, sulfur dioxide, and mercury from being released into the environment.
So why keep fiddling around when solar produces no greenhouse gas emissions?
No air pollution.
No water pollution.
And no solid waste. And photovoltaic systems require little land use because they're typically affixed to existing structures.
Texas is already the nation's largest wind energy producer. Since solar works in the daytime,
and wind predominantly at night,
they are a perfect complement to each other.
Balancing generation capacity so that non-polluting renewable power can be available most of the time, with minimal need for fossil fuel backup.
So wake up, Texans.
Wake up to solar. It's a win-win-win.
We could light up Fort Worth, solar panels on every roof. Amarillo, Texarkana, Dallas and Austin too. Shining bright our proud star, an energy sugar plum. Working for us now, it's that big hot Texas sun.
All right. Most appropriate after that song by Frank Meyer and I guess produced by Rick Sternberg.
Yeah, that was my dad, Rick Sternberg, and my stepmother, Annie Borden, on the voiceovers there.
Keeping it all in the family. All right. Well, we're here again back at Shades of Green Energy, KOOP 91.7 on your FM dial and streaming on the web, koop.org. And we have in the studio with us today Kate Galbraith from the Texas Tribune and Colin Meehan from EDF. And so, Kate, tell us, just before we get into the next bill that we want to talk about, a little bit about the Texas Tribune and what makes it unique. You're an online newspaper.
That's right. We're an online nonprofit, texastribune.org. And, you know, really, we're started about a year and a half, 2 years ago. And really, we're trying to dig deeper into some of the policy issues of the state. I mean, I cover energy and water issues, and the idea is just to go into those a little bit deeper, you know, sort of honor our readers with some more information and depth. So, yeah.
Yeah. Well, I enjoy reading it, and I get it in my email box every day. And so is that how most people read it, or do you have people just come online, and or is there a way to join Texas Tribune?
Yeah, you can become a member of the Texas Tribune. There's a link to membership on our website. It doesn't cost too much, and you know, you get invited to sort of more special events and things like that. And we're a fun group, you know.
Right. Well, we can tell that with you in the studio. Well, just real quickly, one question associated with that: do you think this is the future of newspapers? Are you seeing? Are going to see a lot more online type Texas Tribunes?
Wow, how much time do we have?
No, you got 1 minute. I've seen your director give a presentation on that, but you got 1 minute of your opinion.
Well, I think we've done pretty well in the last couple of years and sort of shown that this model can work. You know, we rely for funding on individuals, on corporate members and so on. We put on some events. And so it's a different model of journalism than just the print product, which you buy or you get ads in, but for now it's working.
Yeah, I think it's an interesting model. We'll see how it goes. Well, we've got about 7 minutes remaining, so we wanted to talk about the frack bill. So, queued up there for you.
Sure. Well, the Texas legislature passed a bill that, you know, some members are calling landmark, that will require the disclosure of many of the chemicals involved in this controversial process called hydraulic fracturing, which is a gas drilling technique that involves that they do in the Fort Worth area and some other drilling areas around the state and the country. Basically, it involves shooting a mix of sand, chemicals, and water way underground to break up shale rock, and you extract the gas out of its little pockets.
Right.
But to do that, you need sort of biocides and other types of lubricant chemicals and this sort of thing. And so a lot of people are worried, you know, is this, what's in this stuff? And, you know, is this going to impact my water well, or if I've got a water well there? The industry says it's not, hydraulic fracturing does not impact water. And, you know, they say that it happens like a mile under the aquifers and so on. So, you know, it's safe, but that's, you know, people still
There's
have an concerns.
Opinion there, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, if they haven't seen the movie Gasland, they might get a different opinion. I don't know if you've seen that, but so the bill is particular to Texas, and I'm curious, how did they get that through? Because my understanding, and I guess not detailed research, is that our last vice president was responsible for getting a bill through that. Somehow allowed those fracking industries to not have to, it even exempt them from having to give the chemicals to whatever agency they were supposed to do that. Mm-hmm. So this is reversing that?
Well, I think the industry has felt some pressure from the public. You know, there's a lot of fear out there, and particularly fear of the unknown. And so I think they came forward with this bill, and EDF was very much a part of crafting this this legislation. Maybe Colin can talk about that.
Yeah, I mean, my colleague Scott Anderson was was instrumental in working with industry on it. And I think you're right. It really came down to the industry felt the push. They had a group, Environmental Defense Fund, that was willing to work with them. And there was also a really good champion in the legislature, I think, in Chairman Keffer. I think he did a very good job. It is an important bill from our perspective. It's a big step forward for the state. We don't necessarily see it as a model for national hydraulic fracturing issues, because we still think there are some substantial problems with it, but it is a big step forward.
And I think one of the objectives of Texas in doing this is, you know, well, we can handle this, federal government, you know.
Oh, okay, so it's an anti-Washington bill in a certain sense. Oh, okay.
Yeah, it's, you know, we're going to act first. And there are a number of states that are putting together different types of hydraulic fracturing disclosure bill. Wyoming has rules that require some disclosure. Arkansas, you know, it's kind of a hodgepodge, and but there's also considerable concern in the environmental community that there's trade secrets provisions in the bill where some of these ingredients can still be kept off the public website after you through an application process, you know, to regulators. So, you know, we're not going to know everything.
Yeah. So there may be some loopholes, like a lot of bills that end up starting out really strong, and then maybe somebody sneaks in a little loophole. But for now, it seems like it has a little bit of teeth and is requiring the frack industry to at least disclose what they're putting down into the earth.
It's requiring them to disclose it. Unfortunately, it's not making that information readily available. It's actually going to take, and I was talking to Scott about this, it's going to take an organization like Texas Tribune that's willing to dig into each of the reports, because they're not going to be in a way that's readable to the layperson, to the homeowner who's having a well drilled nearby or something like that.
Yeah, well, I did see that movie, and it was quite disturbing. And you don't know how much was embellished and how much was over exaggerated, but it was quite scary to see the guy light his faucet on fire. And whether that had anything to do with the fracking, we don't know. But that's the claim. And so a lot of the industry is saying, and I've seen that analysis, that the fracking is so far down compared to where the water is that they don't intermingle. And
That's right, but there are also issues with not just the fracturing process itself that's so far underground, but how do you construct the gas well that you pour all this stuff down, and you know, how do you dispose of water that you've water with the sand and this chemicals that you've, you know, used in this process. So there are a lot of sort of technicalities here. Yeah. It's a complex subject.
Complex. Well, you both deal with a lot of complex and difficult issues. And well, thanks for coming by. You've been listening to Shades of Green Energy. We've got to make room for the Queen of Spoons and Food Love Austin coming up at the top of the hour. But we've had Kate Galbraith in the studio with us from the Texas Tribune and Colin Meehan from EDF. We've got about 10 seconds each to give your website and how to get more information on some of the things we've been talking about today.
Well, texastribune.org is where you can find me and all the other folks.
All right.
And we're at edf.org, and we've got a lot of blog posts and about these kinds of issues.
All right. Well, thanks for coming by, guys.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
You have been listening to Shades of Green Energy, recorded live at KOOP 91.7 in Austin, Texas.